This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, May 18th, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, at the G8 summit, President Obama unveils a plan to confront food insecurity in Africa, but some say the reliance on multinationals could make the situation worse. In Yemen, an increase of military attacks and airstrikes could mean a new phase of U.S. involvement in the country. And protests continue in Chicago as activists push NATO leaders to address the human costs of war. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. German police detained 400 anti-austerity protesters in Frankfurt today as thousands took to the streets. The demonstrators are taking part in a four-day Blockupy protest organized by about 40 different organizations. The protests in Germany's financial capital are due to run through Saturday. FSRN's Cinnamon Nepard has more.
Demonstrators defied German authorities who banned the protests yesterday and today. German police have locked down the city's financial district, blocking streets around the European Central Bank and minimizing traffic outside the Deutsche Bank headquarters. Protesters are criticizing the way that governments are responding to the financial crisis, saying that austerity measures are punishing ordinary people for the actions of banks and investors. The European Central Bank has come under fire but has defended its position on austerity, saying the measures have already prevented a major credit crunch. Around 30,000 protesters are expected over the weekend. Cinnamon Nippard, FSRN, Germany.
In India, the controversy continues over how to dispose of toxic waste left at a U.S. company's industrial site after the 1984 Bhopal gas disaster. Local communities have balked at proposals to incinerate the waste nearby, and now an international option is emerging. FSRN's Shreya Niazi reports from Bhopal.
The Madhya Pradesh government and German company GIZ held talks this week about the waste remaining at the Union Carbide plant in Bhopal. GIZ had recently offered to incinerate 350 metric tons of toxic waste at a facility in Hamburg, Germany. A team from the company visited the Carbide plant and met with state government officials. Local media report GIZ is likely to charge $2.6 million US for airlifting and disposing of the waste. National officials had recommended that the waste be incinerated at a plant in Prithampura in Madhya Pradesh. But the state government and NGOs have opposed that plan, arguing that the local facility is not capable of handling the toxic waste. The Indian Supreme Court halted the Prithampura disposal plan late last week. Shura Niazi, FSRN, Bhopal.
Documents released this week by the Florida State Attorney's Office reveal several new pieces of information about the Trayvon Martin shooting incident. Among them was a police report that found George Zimmerman could have avoided a confrontation with the African-American teen if he had stayed in his car and waited 6 minutes for the authorities to arrive. The police report called the incident ultimately avoidable. The report also said there was no indication that Martin was involved in any criminal activity. Police photos and a medical report leaked to media yesterday did indicate Zimmerman had been injured in a scuffle, and other documents reveal it had been Zimmerman calling for help during a confrontation with Martin. In another interview released, Martin's girlfriend, who was on the phone with the teen right before he was shot, said Trayvon was out of breath after running away from someone. The unnamed girl also said she had heard Martin asking why the person was following him and then yelling, "Get off!" A toxicology report did show Martin's blood had trace amounts of THC, the chemical in marijuana, but CNN reports that the levels would not even have been enough to get someone arrested for DUI in some states. The new political party Americans Elect is shutting down its primary process, saying no candidate gained enough national support to qualify for the group's online convention planned for June. There had been speculation that the political group would put forth a candidate anyway, since it had gained ballot access in a majority of U.S. states. But in a statement posted Thursday, party leadership said that Americans Elect had from the outset been a rules-based process, and that the rules governing convention qualification would stand. The group also said it intends to continue its mission of, quote, creating more choice in our political system. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Doreen Marina in Los Angeles. Leaders of the world's eight wealthiest countries are gathering at Maryland's Camp David today for the G8 summit, and one of the main issues on the agenda is the ongoing food and water crisis in West Africa. President Obama announced a sweeping food security initiative this morning involving both national governments and multinational corporations. But some experts are concerned about an increased reliance on the private sector, including companies that promote pesticides and GMO crops. FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Cargill, DuPont, and Monsanto are three of at least 45 corporations to sign on to President Obama's new Alliance for Food Security and Nutrition, and they've collectively pledged more than $3 billion to the effort to bring more than 50 million Africans out of poverty and hunger. On his way to the G8 summit at Camp David, the president described the plan, which involves coordination between governments in Africa, G8 nations, NGOs, and corporations. He says the new initiative will serve both humanitarian and profit motives.
Food security is a moral imperative, but it's also an economic imperative. History teaches us that one of the most effective ways to pull people and entire nations out of poverty is to invest in their agriculture. And as we've seen, from Latin America to Africa to Asia, a growing middle class also means growing markets, including more customers for American exports that support American jobs. So we have a self-interest in this.
But food justice advocates worry the participating corporations also have a self-interest in the initiative. Chemical company DuPont has pledged more than $3 million towards projects in Ethiopia, including insect control for cotton and vegetables and expansion of seed production. And biotech giant Monsanto, who has pledged $50 million to the project, says it will introduce new maize hybrids suitable for Tanzania. J.D. Hansen with the Center for Food Safety says these companies have a history of behaviors that exacerbate food insecurity, such as pushing genetically modified seeds and chemical pesticides on small-scale farmers.
These companies have, for the most part, developed technologies that are primarily intended to help sell their pesticides. You know, that's not what the actual problem is in third world countries. Most of the firms also really want to control their intellectual property quite tightly, so that a farmer would need to get loans every year to buy the seed to plant it.
A study co-authored last year by the Center for Food Safety also found that genetically modified crops have failed to increase production in many case studies. Furthermore, researchers say bioengineered plants have increased farmer dependency and poverty, threatened human and animal health, and led to the rise of spray-resistant superweeds and superbugs in many areas. The president's announcement comes as the Sahel region of Africa faces another food crisis. Oxfam International estimates that at least 18 million people are currently at risk of starvation due to drought, poor harvests, displacement, and soaring food prices. Gregory Adams with Oxfam says climate change is a major contributor to the crisis, but actions to address it are absent from this new initiative.
Climate should definitely needs to be a part of the conversation, and the people who are living most closely with it are smallholder farmers in the developing world who are dealing with the impacts of climate change on a regular basis. It impacts, in many cases, whether or not they're going to have a good year or a bad year, whether or not they're going to be able to make enough to provide for their families and get a little bit ahead, or whether they're going to be pushed further into poverty, depending on climatic conditions that are beyond their control. There are challenges here that they cannot solve on their own. It requires the collective will of the global community.
In Durban, South Africa last year, representatives from the G8 countries and other nations failed to create a binding agreement to address the warming and destabilized global atmosphere, but pledged to develop one by 2015. Meanwhile, the leaders of Tanzania, Ethiopia, Ghana, and Benin will join the heads of the G8 countries at Camp David this weekend. Besides food insecurity, the White House says the talks will also touch on the nuclear programs of Iran and North Korea, continuing violence in Syria, the struggling Eurozone economy, and post-2014 Afghanistan, among other topics. Occupy DC members and other demonstrators will be gathering outside the heavily secured grounds. They say they're protesting the G8's, quote, concentrated wealth and corporatism that has looted resources and brought the economy and environment to the breaking point. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Food insecurity is a problem faced by many throughout the world, and as debates about broad policies and strategies get the attention, it is a day-to-day struggle for millions. In Pakistan, one woman has taken a stand against hunger in her community, and by feeding hundreds of people each day, hopes to help break the cycle of poverty and violence. Catherine Kopp reads for our reporter in Pakistan, Gabe Matthews.
Down a narrow road and past small houses in Karachi is a destination many locals make their way to every day. Inside a two-room building, cooks prepare a South Asian bread called roti in a brick tandoor oven, while others set up chairs and tables on a veranda. This is Khana Ghar, Pakistan's version of a soup kitchen. Run by 53-year-old Saida Perveen, a journalist by profession, the poor and low-wage workers have come here for meals for the last 10 years. Perveen says she was inspired by tragic events.
A mother killed two of her children in Karachi only because she could not provide food to them. Then I realized that hunger can vanish even a mother's love for her children. I went to meet and ask her the reason, and she told me that you would kill your children if you find your children hungry. You will do the same. You will kill your children too, the way I kill them, if you could not provide them food. Then I decided to start from my home to feed 2, 4, or 10 people, and this was the start.
Written on a wall in the soup kitchen is the message, "Hunger breeds crimes. We should eliminate it." An estimated 20% of people in Pakistan live below the poverty line. Perveen says tackling poverty will also help to address the country's other problems.
We have many challenges ahead. Pakistan is passing through a crisis. We have the worst law and order situation. Our system is failing to provide justice, and we have a financial crisis. We have nothing to offer to the poor. It is not a crime to be Pakistani. The poor has a right to get all basic human rights like food, but they are deprived of their basic rights.
Although Perveen started out small, feeding just a handful of neighbors and local workers, her efforts have grown. Now she feeds 400 to 500 people, and they pay 3 rupees, or about 4 cents per meal. The menu changes every day. Today, it's mixed vegetable day. Almost everyone in line is holding a plate. Some of those waiting for a meal are local children who come here before they go to school. Dressed in a school uniform, 7-year-old Umar adjusts his tie with one hand while holding money in the other.
I am Umar and studying in grade 2. My father has a hand cart. We have 6 people at home, me, my 3 sisters, and parents. I pay 10 cents to get food for all of them. Our gas connection at home has been cut, so we buy food from here. Soon we will restore our gas at home.
The majority of those in line are women and children. Many local men are daily wage laborers. And some women feel ashamed to stand in line for the cheap food. 27-year-old Humaira is a mother of 2 daughters. Her husband works as a mason. She comes here every day.
I have a bad financial situation at my house, but here we can get food for only 12 cents. I do not have anything at home to cook for my children. It's stressful. People stare at me because I come here at noon and in the evening. I feel very shy when I come out of the house, therefore I cover my face. But what should I do, because I do not have anything else to do except to take food from here.
Many of the poor are elderly, who not only are trying to take care of themselves, but others in their family. Wearing broken glasses and shabby clothes, this woman told FSRN her four sons work in big companies, but they don't support her.
They have left me with the disabled son and daughter-in-law. I can't beg, but only get food for the disabled ones from here. I don't take much for myself, but only for my disabled son and his wife. It is how I pass my days of life.
In addition to the soup kitchen, Saida Parveen also runs a clinic for the poor. Despite her accomplishments, she expresses surprise at what she's done so far.
I'm a common lady from a middle-class family that doesn't have any relations with people from the elite class. I've spent 10 precious years of my life on a cause. I have a different concept. I want the poor to work and buy their own food so they don't have to beg for it and so their children won't have to beg too.
Parveen says she hopes her model can be expanded. She'd also like to help finance girls' education. Reading for Gabe Matthews in Karachi, this is Catherine Comp, FSRN.
In Yemen, U.S.-supported military strikes have stepped up this week. On Monday, government planes and soldiers struck a base in southern Yemen that the U.S. said was an al-Qaeda stronghold, killing at least 29, according to the AP. Two suspected U.S. drone attacks on Tuesday killed 12 civilians, and residents near the town of Shibam in the central part of the country reported missile strikes on Thursday. For more, we're joined by Ibrahim Khattab. He's a Yemeni American human rights activist. He's also a legal worker with the Center for Constitutional Rights and joins us from New York. Welcome to FSRN.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the military action this week. Government said 44 were killed Monday and Tuesday in military attacks in the Abyan province. Is it clear what the U.S. role has been in these recent attacks?
It's not very much clear at this point, but there's a lot of reports that talk about the U.S. having troops on the ground, providing all kind of assistance to the Yemeni military, as well as taking over airspaces and some airports in the south. So it seems like they very much coordinated all these efforts together. And so I'm sure the U.S. have a major role in this.
And there are U.S. forces stationed at an air base in Laj province, the Al-Anad Air Base, right?
Yeah, the Anad Air Base is very close and is one of the most important air bases in Yemen.
You mentioned the U.S. also taking over some airspaces in the area. There's also been a step up of drone attacks. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism says 12 civilians were killed in two U.S.-backed drone attacks on Tuesday this week. There was another missile strike Thursday yesterday, according to residents near the town of Shibam. How about the increase of these drone attacks and the effect on civilians and residents there?
The drone strikes are completely a serious issues in Yemen, and they can cause more harm than good. For example, in Majlis case, where more than three families got wiped out, civilian families that have nothing to do with any kind of extremism or terrorism, and the, you know, the state of Marib as well, you know, the deputy governor was targeted, who was part of the government and has nothing to do with anything. So there's some serious issues and the causes of, and that might create real serious issues. For example, help the al-Qaeda recruit people, because when many people see that their family members, civilians, being targeted and killed, and there is no explanation of why their family members and a lot of civilians are being killed, who knows what the numbers of civilians are being murdered at this point. And we don't even know the number, and we don't even know how they target in these cities and how they target in these militants in Yemen.
This week, President Obama also signed an executive order that allows the U.S. to freeze the assets of anyone or any entity who, quote, obstructs the political transition in Yemen. Is it clear how this order could be implemented moving forward?
This order, in my opinion, is very vague. it appears to me in the first place that it is so vague and poorly drafted and so broad that it could infringe on the First Amendment rights of the free speech. What about, like, as Yemeni Americans, what about when Saleh comes to the United States and we hold a peaceful protest against him? Would that considered as, going against the GCC initiative? What about protesters in Yemen march towards the Yemeni cabinet and ask everyone in the cabinet to resign? What would that do? So there's a lot of questions that the Obama administration needs to answer around this order, and we'll see what they're going to do with it going forward.
Ibrahim Khattab is a Yemeni-American human rights activist. He joined us to talk about the increase in military action in Yemen. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Thanks a lot.
Protests continued in Chicago ahead of the NATO summit this weekend, with nurses drawing attention to inadequate health care and calling for taxes on Wall Street. Organizers from the National Nurses United said the rally moved forward at Daly Square after city officials reversed a pledge to block the protest. Also this morning, police released a group of people without charges after arresting them Wednesday. Police suspected them of planning to make Molotov cocktails and raided an apartment late Wednesday night, according to the Chicago Tribune. But lawyers say those arrested had only beer-making equipment and called it a fear campaign. As protesters prepare to face heavy police presence this weekend, NATO leaders are expected to discuss troop withdrawal in Afghanistan and an ongoing presence past 2014, missile defense and surveillance, and enlarging the military alliance. One topic that's not on the agenda is the plight of refugees, people uprooted because of armed conflict. Human rights advocates say this heavy cost of war needs to be addressed. From Chicago, FSRN's Jay Sapir reports.
According to the United Nations Refugee Agency, more than 5 million Afghan people have been displaced from their homes. It's the biggest refugee crisis the agency has ever dealt with. Even when people repatriate to Afghanistan, they face hardships, and an estimated 40% haven't been able to go back to their native communities. Activist and Nobel Peace Prize nominee Kathy Kelly recently visited Afghanistan, where she saw firsthand the impacts of the NATO war.
Every single day, there are 400 people that are displaced in Kabul and other cities across Afghanistan, displaced by war. The United States, as the occupying power, actually has responsibility for finding housing, but instead they end up in wretched, squalid refugee camps.
Kelly works with Voices for Creative Nonviolence and has also campaigned on the refugee crisis caused by other U.S.-led wars.
And in Iraq, there are 2 million people displaced externally and 2.2 million displaced internally. Again, the United States has responsibility, but the people have been treated as though they're worth less than the dust under our shoes in both places.
Kelly recently attended the Nobel Laureate Summit here in Chicago, where many human rights advocates were gathered, including Kassar Abdullah, Director of Advocacy and Education at Tennessee Immigrant and Refugee Rights Coalition. Kassar was a refugee herself, following the Iraq-led attack on Kurdistan in 1988.
And so I remember we walked by foot. It seemed like we were walking forever. It was cold in the mountains. We had to cross the mountain over, hungry, and the only clothes that we had were the ones that we wore. I remember we walked for about 3 days and three nights until we crossed the border. And I remember starving.
Refugees often must live in overcrowded camps with limited access to basic supplies. Many refugees, including young people, are also subject to abuse and sexual exploitation. Jane Allen works with the group Invisible Conflicts, a student-led social justice organization.
We don't hear about things like refugee camps that have been attacked or refugees that have been hurt. And I think that's a very, very saddening thing because, I mean, what does it have to take for the United States to pay attention to those refugees? I mean, we pay attention to our soldiers, which is expected because they're very heroic. But why don't we pay attention to the refugees, the innocent people that are there as well?
Illinois itself experienced an influx of refugees. In 2003, it had no Iraqi refugees. 6 years later, the state led the country with more than 3,000. Although that number started to dwindle, thousands of refugees from Iraq continue to flee, many of them coming to the U.S. Over the last 7 months, about 3,500 Iraqi refugees entered the U.S. The number of Afghan refugees coming here over that same period was less than 200. Jay Saper, FSRN, Chicago.
2 years after deadly clashes between Thai troops and opposition protesters, authorities have been slow to bring to justice military and government officials responsible for the violence. Human Rights Watch and other advocates are calling for prosecution in the deaths of dozens of people. But now the government says it has plans to pass a general amnesty through parliament. FSRN's Ron Corbin reports from Bangkok.
Human rights advocates warn of a growing climate of impunity in Thailand because leaders have failed to bring charges against soldiers or officials 2 years after deadly protests. More than 90 people died and up to 2,000 were injured, mostly civilians. During the 2 months of protests led by supporters known as red shirts of deposed Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat. Brad Adams with Human Rights Watch says the military should not be above the law, and the Justice Ministry's Department of Special Investigations, or DSI, should be investigating.
Only 16 cases have been forwarded from the DSI for official post-mortem investigations, which is when the criminal process would be triggered. It's inexplicable. There's no good reason why they stopped at 16, except that the military clearly does not want these investigations to go forward.
Human Rights Watch says red shirt supporters were also responsible for violence, but hundreds were arrested and charged, and more than 50 remain in prison. The Thai government under Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat appears to be pressing ahead with plans for a reconciliation bill or general amnesty, a move not supported by families of victims or rights groups. Again, Brad Adams.
Our goal today is to remind people about the victims of the violence and the fact that there thus far has been no justice for those victims.
One of those to lose their lives was a volunteer medic, Katakamon Akhard, who was shot by troops while attending those injured in a Buddhist temple near the protest site. Her brother, Nataput, opposes the amnesty.
Regarding the reconciliation and amnesty, I disagree with that. If in this country murder can be committed and then there is a whitewash to allow impunity, then there should be no law, there shouldn't be any constitution. Thailand would be a lawless country.
On Saturday, red shirt protesters will gather to mark the second anniversary of the demonstrations and call for justice for those killed. Tens of thousands are expected to participate. Ron Corbin, FSRN, Bangkok.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Etter and Zane Carisley. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news story specials and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.